This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Joe, welcome to the show this week.
Mark, how's it going?
It's going very, very well.
What a week.
I know. One of the biggest travel issues at the moment in Melbourne is, of course, for the Australian Open. People are here from all over the world, and I haven't noticed as many overseas tourists around town who are inbound and who are enjoying Melbourne.
Oh, that must be because the dollar's still high.
No, it's for the game. The one game. They're going for many, but they're getting there. And it's good to see all the people on public transport. It's quite interesting that people who come from overseas have managed to understand the Mikey instructions it's been written for a three-year-old. And it's amazing how many Melburnians are still whining years down the track.
Well, isn't it interesting? I think it's a little bit like relationships. If you travel frequently and have lots of relationships, you don't have the baggage.
It could be.
And I'm thinking that Melburnians have a lot of baggage when it comes to Mikey.
It could be a lot of people just don't get on with it as well.
Yep.
It's there. Just use it. The backpacker community in St Kilda is bulging. And this week I've been speaking to a few people on the tram around St Kilda, and they're saying, where is this lovely warm weather that Melbourne's supposed to have at this time of the year? And it's hard for them to understand, people who have arrived in the last few days, that it was 47 this time last year.
Yeah, they'll get with
you. Yeah. It'll change, but they're all having a ball anyway, and there's lots of fun things going on, including the Pride March tomorrow in St Kilda. Are you going?
Big event.
Big event?
No, I'm not, actually. I'll be heading off to another location.
Me too. Unfortunately, I can't make it this year. I was hoping to, but everybody, if you're not doing anything this weekend, make sure that Pride March is on your list. St Kilda goes off tomorrow. You're like a frog in a sock. I think probably the biggest global news of the week was MH370 being declared an accident, finally.
There was a lot that competes with that award for best news story this week. I mean, look at what happened in Greece.
I think it's biggest, but not best.
Okay, all right.
News story. What happened in Greece this week?
Well, they had a bit of an election, just as the Queenslanders
are about
anywhere.
To
do. Maybe not for some time.
No. Yeah, okay, yeah, the big election in Greece, which was fascinating to see, but the socialists are basically back in town.
And still makes it a good place for travellers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Greece is fantastic. I don't know what's going to happen to the EU, though. So it's be interesting to watch it. They've got some very young, very bright people leading SUSRO, or however you pronounce the party, which I've never been able to fathom. How do you pronounce it?
Not Golden Dawn.
No, it wasn't Golden Dawn. They're the other end of the spectrum. But, yeah, the lefties are in, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with their $360 billion debt and how they're going to pay for it. That's a lot of Ouzo, Drunken Knights and Mykonos to pay
for
that one.
I think we've got a guest in the studio who knows a little bit about big numbers.
Mm, Ian.
Yes, welcome,
welcome,
Ian.
Welcome to Joy 94.9.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us, Ian. Ian, let's talk, just in a nutshell, tell us about your career. And is avionics a word?
avionics is a word for the instrumentation. In a nutshell, I was born into the aviation industry. I had an uncle that was maybe 15 years older than me. As I was a very young boy, he was learning to fly and become an airline pilot. So he would take me up flying with him. Mm-hmm. And so that was always my aspiration growing up, was to enter aviation. And I guess when I was, late teens, finishing school, starting university, doing engineering or maths or something else, never held any appeal. And so I became an air traffic controller.
Okay, stop. Is it really the most stressful job in the world?
Look, I didn't find it that stressful.
It's
challenging, but I think how I answer the stress issue was it was a desire to do a really good job.
Okay.
That
does it attract perfectionists? Is that part of the reason why it's considered stressful?
I wouldn't have called it that, but certainly it can be a bit unrelenting. it can be with a lot of aircraft trying to get in the same space at one time. It can be sort of adrenaline-inducing.
I mean, it's the one shot that they throw to in a movie when something bad's going to happen.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my goodness, the dots are coming closer.
Yeah, they do.
Did you ever use the expression, I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue?
No, I didn't. But I think you have a professional tolerance to all that stuff.
Okay. Mm. So it's a 24-hour job. Oh, which airport were you with?
I was sort of a number of airports in New Zealand.
Right, okay. Yeah. And were they flying? Were they receiving flights 24 hours a day?
Yeah.
Okay.
So look, you work 24 hours a day. The hours were pretty good in many ways. Mm. I didn't like night shifts, to be blunt.
Just because it mucks up your circadian
rhythm? Yeah, we used to start sort of, you know, late in the afternoon, say 4:30 or 5, working to midnight, then progressively work earlier in the day with sort of culminating in the fourth shift being a night shift. Mm. So you're actually concertining sort of four shift into 3 days. So, I found it, pretty exhausting, actually. Mm. I struggled with night shifts, so I wasn't sorry to get out of that.
Would you say that air traffic control is a long-term career prospect for anybody? Do people make whole careers out of it, or is it something that you do as a part of a career, like overarching structure?
Do you know what? It depends very much on the type of person you are. For me, I wasn't like that. Probably when a lot of these that sort of thinking occurred in my late 20s, I'd recently finished a degree. I was looking around me. I had sort of a bit of wanderlust about other things I could maybe do. I saw the guys that I was peers with, and those that were in supervisory or managerial mm-hmm. roles. And I thought, can I see myself doing this job for the next 40 years? And I thought, no. So I sort of thought, whilst I really enjoyed the job, I loved it. And it took me a lot of years to get over it from when I moved into a managerial job.
Why?
Why did I do it?
No. Why did it take you so much time to get over it? Did you miss it?
Incredibly so. It was fun. I used to love going to work.
Did you really?
I loved it.
So I don't see that with air traffic control because I see it as a very stressful occupation.
Yeah, no,
so maybe I've got
it.
The wrong end of the stick.
I just love going to work.
So what was a day in the life of air traffic control? Why is it such a lovable thing to do with your life?
I enjoyed the profession and the industry. I had amazing camaraderie with the people I worked with, by and large. The challenge to do a really great job was there. And the actual challenge of handling this traffic situation.
Right.
I just found it incredible.
How would your job have differed to, say, Ireland, which is where air traffic control is such a big deal because it's the first bit of land from United States to Europe or the last from Europe to United States? So that's hugely traffic corridor. So that's a really focused kind of thing. What kind of differences would there be in that kind of space?
There's various types of air traffic control jobs or roles, if you like. The control towers, you have ground movement, surface movement controllers and aerodrome controllers. Then the next tier of airspace around an airport is what they call approach radar controllers, where it was aircraft that are coming in and going out. That's quite a quick-moving piece of airspace. Then the next tier is what they call en route, so where aircraft are flying largely in level flight but for long distance. And the sort of what you alluded to in terms of Ireland, where you have sort of the oceanic areas where aircraft are going on their route, staying on the same route, the same altitude
for hours.
Mm. So very different types of roles.
Because they're not necessarily landing in Ireland; they're just passing.
No, just
so they get handed
off.
Ireland says.
Yeah, so they'll be seeing or be taking control of aircraft midway between, you know, I suppose Iceland, Canada, and then to the UK and over to Norway. But it very much depends, you know, the type of technology you have, the type of work that's there, the type of immediacy of the role. Very much depends on the airport or operational role that you're performing.
So how has technology changed the role over the past... When were you doing this in
late 80s.
Yeah.
Look, massively so. Massively so. And we're seeing incredible changes in technology happening now.
Who drives that innovation? Does it come from within the sector, or is it coming from the periphery, such as, you know, NASA's programs?
Both, Joe. What's happening is, in the old days, it was very much... the air traffic control was very much a ground-based system. But what's happened in recent times is, particularly in Europe and North America, bits in Australia, around around your Sydney's...
where traffic congestion is high.
Yes. And they're trying to, and the big challenge is what can we do to meet the continued traffic volumes or greater traffic volumes that are expected to sort of massively increase... but at the same time, reduce the cost of service delivery.
Yes.
So,
because anything that happens on the ground is going to cost a lot of money, isn't it?
Sure, but it means you're just piling infrastructure on infrastructure, and it's got we've reached a stage whereby the ground type systems and the ground based air traffic control type activities are starting about as much as they can.
So they're reaching critical capacity.
So yes. So what's sort of happening now is that, and this is sort of, we'll talk about it, but this is where my interest in the PhD, my PhD interest is that if you look at the aviation environment and you're looking, and that includes airlines, airports, and air traffic control, it's to say, well, hold on, can we change those responsibilities away from the air traffic controller to be assumed maybe more by the flight deck or other responsibilities taken by the airports in terms of strategically managing, the schedules of aircraft that fly at an airport to actually enable the whole system to both reduce costs and at the same time be able to handle more aircraft.
Wow, that's quite critical change, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm kind of blown away at the complexity of all that because it's stuff that happens outside
behind the scenes. Yeah.
Exactly. So people don't have a real appreciation. We know that there's a pilot and we know that there's cabin crew. We can see people putting the bags on the plane. We can see people doing check-in. We can see so many of the airport services in front of house. But when it comes to that control, it's fascinating how much it's changed. We've got a lot more questions for you as we go through the show.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Ian Thompson on Escape Pod here with Mark and Joe on Joy 94.9. You're a aviation expert. You've spent a lot of your career working as, well, the early part of your career working as an air traffic controller. And one of the things we're briefly talking about is airports aren't just a place for your recreational business traveller. There's a lot of other air traffic that's coming and going that most people probably don't pay attention to. What kind of traffic comes and goes that you were controlling and what percentages of the traffic does that make up?
Look, it depends very much at the airport that you're working at. For example, you see the run-of-mill like Melbourne or Sydney, mm-hmm. high numbers of,
FedEx.
Jet aircraft, your Qantas, Virgin, your international flight, you've got your freight aircraft. At other airports, you'll be having a mix of light aircraft, mm-hmm. And that becomes a challenge, particularly at the aerodrome, of mixing the lighter, lower-performing aircraft in amongst the high-performing, quicker aircraft. You can have the military jets or military aircraft flying through.
Like in Bali?
Sure, yeah.
Or Goa, it's you land commercial lands at military airports.
Absolutely, like Darwin. Darwin,
yep.
Newcastle.
Yep.
You very much have a mix of aircraft. So, and a menu from an air traffic control perspective, it's that mix that and the judgment that you have to apply in managing those aircraft. That's a real art.
But most pilots are very military-minded, aren't they? It comes from nearly a naval tradition. There's a captain and, there's a hierarchy.
There's a chain of command, Mark.
Yep. And they talk in a very specific way, and this is and mostly in English.
Largely in English. ICAO is the language of ICAO is English. However, you do get instances whereby, say, nationals in their own country, they will talk.
And that's a really interesting issue that you've both just raised, because I think that was something that was brought up with the recent AirAsia crash with QZ8501, was the potential for miscommunication between the crew and whether or not they were all talking English.
Yes. See, now, there's a few issues with that. From an air traffic control perspective, when you're dealing with foreign pilots, our training is very standard phraseologies.
Mm.
So they try to minimise any chance of
ambiguity.
Yes, exactly. The problem is, if you're starting to use with ambiguity or if there's confusion, if people and pilots say that are processing things in another mm-hmm. language, and things are going awry, or there's a stressful situation,
yes,
then that makes things harder to process and react to.
And do you think that could have been part of the issue with AirAsia?
I don't know. I think there's other things that seem to be more prevalent and more causal than probably that.
Mm.
And what do you think those things could be?
Well, looking at this morning, clearly everyone's aware that there was a lot of thunderstorm activity.
Mm.
But
tropical areas.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the other thing that I was looking at, in fact, this morning from a reputable aviation website, was that on board the aircraft, there's a lot of computerisation, and that AirAsia aircraft had difficulties with its flight augmentation computer. There was instances where it had failed or there had been logged as being faulty 9 times in 2014.
Right.
Now what happened was, according to this website, was that the captain left his seat to go and turn off, by way of the circuit breakers, the dual flight augmentation computer. The concern is now what the flight augmentation computer does. It protects the speed envelope of the aircraft, among other things, and it provides
protection. What's the speed envelope?
Well, it'll be looking at the speed an aircraft can operate safely at when it's climbing or descending.
Right.
So it turned that off, and it provides what they call stall protection for the aircraft.
Is it a bit like turning off then your traction control in the car?
Yeah, that's possibly like, a good. Mm. That's probably a good analogy. Yeah. Now, what
stalling would be a bad thing in the air, right?
Well, things fall out of the sky when they storm.
Well, gravity is a constant.
But hold that thought, because what was claimed on this website was that the captain was sort of busy tinkering with the flight augmentation computer, which was behind him. The first officer was supposedly
on the sticks.
Got the sticks, but maybe was looking to what the captain was doing. The question is, was the first officer paying proper attention to the upcoming thunderstorm activity on the weather radar? That's a question. Okay, so if you can imagine, they've turned off the systems that make the aircraft easier to fly,
mm-hmm.
and the protections that around speed that the aircraft has. It's careering for the thunderstorm. Now, within the thunderstorm, what you have is amazing updrafts and downdrafts, you know, mm-hmm. if you like, side by side of each other in the actual thunderstorm. So the aircraft, according to reports, wanted to climb through it.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed at over 30,000 feet, all of a sudden it was climbing at 6,000 feet a minute. Now, that is huge.
That's almost sort of ballistic territory, isn't it?
Yes. Well, what you're looking
at... What kind of gradient? So the trolley would be rolling back.
Yes. And really, to put in perspective, for an A320 at over 30,000 feet, it'd be sort of climbing at around 1,000 feet a minute normally. So
six times the normal
amount. So if you imagine that the nose is pointed up, and then all of a sudden... The wind conditions or the air conditions change, and the aircraft's nose and attitude is pointing high. Then there's sort of downdraft, or it loses lift, and in a moment, you see what the stall is when the lift over the wings subsides.
Right, so then gravity takes over.
Yeah, but what happens is, though, that the nose of the air, how you get away from it is that the aircraft slows but doesn't stop, and then the nose pitches forward, and you go down a little bit to stabilize the stabilize the lift and speed, and you come out of it. In this case, it seemed like the aircraft stalled. Nose went down. They probably hit a massive sort of downdraft and created almost a dive. Now, there were reports that the aircraft was descending at 24,000 feet a minute. And that is
four times as much as it was ascending.
Yeah, but let's put it in perspective. That's around about eight to nine times the descent angle that an aircraft would normally have.
Hold that thought. We
most definitely, yes.
Think we know what happens next.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
What's your take on Michelle Obama not wearing a head covering whilst greeting the dignitaries in Saudi Arabia after the death of the king?
I'm kind of 50-50. You know, part of me always tries to be incredibly respectful when you're on the ground in somebody else's culture, and you know, you try not to make waves because your presence quite often is already distracting for people. But on the other side, I guess most women that I know would think that most of the laws that are the law of the land are not ones that favour women.
And I think that's a fair stab. Ian, you spent some time in Saudi Arabia as part of your career. I've spent some time in Dubai. Joe certainly travelled extensively around the world and spent some time in areas. Usually dignitaries, Western dignitaries, don't, unless they're inside a mosque, for example, actual place of worship, don't necessarily cover the hair. The Queen Elizabeth certainly hasn't ever.
No, unless she's got a tiara. A I mean, you know, I think tiara trumps burqa,
exactly.
Anything else,
yeah.
Isn't it?
If it's a couple hundred grand or it's priceless, it's on your head, mate. That's how she talks, right?
It could be when she gets her next award from the Prime Minister.
Oh, Tony. One term, Tony. Not even going to be one term at the rate that he's going. We'll have a bishop or a rook.
It could be. Mm. Ian, what did you do in Saudi Arabia? Was it designing airports?
No, it was similar. The Saudis purchased a Talas air traffic control system, and they needed...
What's that?
Basically, like radar displays.
Right. Candy Crush for serious people.
Yeah. So they... But they needed to figure out how it was going to work. What I mean, right. not in a technical way,
yeah.
But more in an operational way.
Right, and so they needed some pretty significant training and coaching. And
yeah, but this was more in terms of the, you know, it was actually sort of looking, it was developing an operational concept plan, not only for both the air traffic control operation, but also from a long-term strategic perspective. So it looked like things like from at a practical level, it looked at the route structures. The sectors that the air traffic controllers would operate. It involved the implementation of a new air traffic control centre in Riyadh,
right.
As well as the one they already had existing in Jeddah. So
working very closely with Saudi?
A little bit,
yeah.
But certainly engaged them in the process, but it also involved, in a fascinating way, the other Gulf states that abutted Saudi Arabia.
So UAE, fantastic. Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait.
Jordan. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and...
not a lot to do with Tel Aviv, I guess.
No, that's not high on their Christmas card list. The other funny one was Yemen to the south.
Yep.
Yeah, and interesting issues with Africa that was over the Red Sea.
Yeah.
So that was very funny because aircraft would turn off their transponders and go up international waters, not speaking to anyone. This is the African Airlines. On the way to the
UK,
so they could save fees. They just turn off the transponder and...
you can't get charged if you haven't logged in.
I'm not listening.
Yeah, it's probably too much detail.
That's fantastic. Now, talking about too much detail, off air, we were talking before we went to a break, listen to the lovely Katie Noonan, we were talking about the QZ8501 flight, and you were explaining the physics and the reality of how a great big bird, how much does the plane weigh? Is it 1,000 tons?
I'm not sure. Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
With a whole bunch of people on it, their luggage and their iPads and their whatever. So it's a lot of stuff that's flying around in the air. So it needs a lot of lift to keep it up.
Mm.
So you were talking to that point before when the air pressure changes. And in that particular flight, there was information that got out. Talk to that again.
Yeah. I was just going to say that the reports are that the aircraft decided to climb out, try and climb above the thunderstorm, but clearly wasn't able to do that. But the point we're talking about, what related to how do we know or how did this website or reports how did they know that the pilot had been,
because they weren't
left
there
the seat. Yeah, left the, and we know that the cockpit voice recorders and the flight data recorders have been recovered, and they'll be they'll have been listened to and transcribed. And what often does happen is that there comes judicious leaks from the authorities out into the media. And I'm sure that this was how that scenario of the pilot leaving his seat and tinkering with the flight system.
And then the case officer
was maybe distracted. So that's how the scenario how people would become aware of that type of scenario.
Mm. It's a tragic,
because what it's doing is it's recording the conversations on the flight deck.
Mm-hmm. It records everything. It also wind speed, altitude.
Yeah.
Last web pages.
Yeah. So initially after the crash occurred, the information would have come out from the air traffic control, but that'd be and that would be in regard to the communication that was recorded between the pilots and the air traffic control, but also the transponder information in the air traffic control system that shows the climb, the level, and the rates of descent that the aircraft was experiencing.
It's definitely food for thought, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's such a tragic thing, all those families. And, we would think of Asian airlines being highly evolved, Asia being such a hugely densely populated area, and also tourism is such a big part of its economy and moving forward. I mean, we know the airlines are good. Malaysian Airlines, great. And it's just such a shame to see that. I mean, getting shot down was no one's fault. But MH370 and what recently happened with QZ85, it's just such a shame to see this blighting a very good record, which we talk about Qantas's record all the time being amazing. So we're going to talk about that and more about your PhD after we come back.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Ian, you're on Escape Pod talking about your career in aviation, which is, it started off with working in air control, and then it went on to quite international, going to several different countries, Mongolia and Saudi Arabia and others, rolling out systems. And that's given you insight into what safety means. And we just touched on that before we listened to Adele. So off air, we were talking about some really fascinating things. Recap on that, the difference between the cheap flights and the flag carriers, what's the gulf of difference in safety that you get when you pay those premium dollars? Mm. And why aren't people paying those premium dollars then? Why isn't it valued?
Well, I was doing research and there
for
was
your
a
PhD?
Survey. No, just outside of it. Oh. But there was a survey conducted before the Malaysian Airlines catastrophes. Mm-hmm. And the survey found that there was 60% of people flying had some sort of aversion or fear of flying. But only 27% of people would choose safety over price. So what you're seeing
is interesting.
So it's fascinating.
I'm scared of it, but I'm scared of giving my money away more.
And that, there you go. And what in practical terms is Qantas has, as we all know, an unbelievable safety record.
Mm.
It's a legacy carrier. Now, what that legacy carrier has is a reasonably modern fleet, but more importantly, an incredibly experienced and high cost crew, particularly pilots.
Yep.
You've got a very strong and very well qualified group of engineers. And you've got a whole host of safety systems.
Which we really don't want to put at risk in terms of an asset for the company.
Yeah, but the problem is what people, as Mark, you flippantly said, but what you said was actually the heart of the matter, is that people, when it comes to parting the dollars, will choose the lower cost option. And hence you've got people would rather pay and go on low-cost carriers. Now, many of the low-cost carriers
with the chickens in the aisle and no safety.
Not quite, but what you're having though is that some of the low-cost carriers are not as highly safety qualified as the likes of Qantas. For example, there is an IATA operational safety audit.
Explain what IATA is.
That's the peak body representing the
international
airlines. Now, part of the requirement for airlines that join IATA is to complete the international
base level
safety audit, operational safety audit, which is a level above the normal regulatory certification requirements that are set. So it's a layer of safety above the minimum requirements. Now, AirAsia, for example, is not part of that that IATA operational safety audit, or is not accredited. And a number of low cost airlines are not. Another sort of stat for you is that airlines that are not accredited with the IATA operational safety audit are 4.3 times more likely to have an accident than those
that are.
But
so would you say, in a nutshell, get your cheap ticket, but make sure they're an IATA member?
I think so.
Minimum.
Yes. In a nutshell, yes. And be clear that you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
Having said all that, aviation's incredibly safe, and believe it or not, 2014 was the safest on record. There was 21 aircraft accidents, and that's one.
Well, there's a lot of planes in the air at any given moment.
And that, in terms of numbers, that's one accident per 1.3 million flights. So it's incredibly safe. But by the same token,
there were some tragic high-profile accidents.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Where a lot of people lost their lives in one go. And that's really kind of skewed the figures a bit,
didn't
it? Or the perception.
Yes.
And what exacerbated the problem? One was, and it's still an unknown entity, and it's nearly a year long, so that mystery drove the media cycle. And the other one was a missile being fired. So that's
yes,
highly irregular
as well.
In a state of conflict. So it brought up a lot of talking heads, which sort of embiggened both of those incidents compared to other incidents. And then another one in Asia just makes everyone go, shame. So what would you say is coming up in aviation over the next few years? What are the big trends?
Well, I think some really interesting changes coming up in the customer experience.
So we're going to get more legroom?
Oh, I
if
wish.
You pay.
Because you're about, what, 6'4"?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, no such luck.
So you got to turn left in a plane to get comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For example, interesting, Qantas is trialling virtual reality goggles.
Oh, yes, I saw that during the week, yeah.
And I've read recently in New Zealand, and Air New Zealand have a display at Te Papa in Wellington, as an aside, if anyone's going, it's well worth the visit. And part of, and in the display, they're showing that they've got a you can put on virtual reality goggles, and what it it's doing is it enables the passenger to sort of be seeing sort of the New Zealand in Air New Zealand's case, the New Zealand wildlife and fauna,
right.
Also, sort of being able to pick on a pitch to place the person's visual senses at least into onto an island, resort island, or
being chased by orcs.
Yes, or even in this case,
New Zealand Air does a fabulous job.
Yeah. So anyway, Qantas are offering that on a 3-month trial to their first class lounge and cabin customers.
Goodness. Well, we're going to have to just keep that list handy and catch up with it in just a minute.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Goodness, hasn't the hour gone quickly?
Flown.
What's
and
happened?
We've got the right person here to talk about flying things. Ian Thompson, where do you see aviation trending? You said that there are some exciting things guest experience-wise.
Yeah, just bear in mind we're about to wrap up. My sense, though, is there's not going to be a lot of a big drop in domestic airfares this coming year. What's happened is that Qantas and Virgin are dropping, are pulling back on seat capacity on their routes. So what you're getting is whilst the dollar's falling and the cost of fuel's falling, but they're also pulling back on the number of seats that are available.
Right.
So in fact, in November,
so they're controlling demand.
Yeah, in November actually fares rose a little bit by 1%. So
they're looking after their business model. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what we all have to bear in mind, that we're going to have to part with our hard-earned to get our bum on a seat, and a lot more hard-on if you want to turn left when you get on a plane. But that's life.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.